Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. That strange purring sound you can hear in the background isn't Smudge the Cat, it's Kieran. It's Kieran enjoying a performance yesterday against Arsenal in Bridge. Brighton scored not one, Kieran, not one, but two goals in the same game. How was that?
Yeah, we had to have written instructions on what to do when we scored as fans, because we sort of looked at each other and said, did we just do that? So a wonderful day out at the Emirates. And I'd like to shout out to Harry, the Arsenal fan. I was having a chat with a few of the old Bill before the match, just because they were asking about Uncle Terry,
of course,
which was very kind of them. And an Arsenal fan recognised the voice and came across and said how much he loved the podcast. So, to Harry, the Arsenal fan, thank you very much for the kind words. And sorry to have ruined your day. And Kevin's equally sorry to have ruined your day on Monday, which means between us, not very much. Yeah. But you know, that's football.
We are currently Tottenham fans' favourite pod at the moment.
Yes.
Although I have to say it did play into the usual media frenzy about your manager. As we speak, Jeff Stelling and several other Sky pundits will be strewing palms in front of Graham Potter's donkey as he makes his triumphant entry into Brighton. It's questions day, Kieran. Palace fans may have noticed I haven't mentioned Leicester because we haven't played them yet, just so you know. I'm assuming we'll win. That's how good things are at the moment, Kieran. And now I'm assuming I'll get the blame if we lose for saying out loud that we'll win. Two stories, though, before some very good questions. The first one is potentially huge, Kieran. It broke on Thursday. Der Spiegel, German magazine, have published what I think you can only describe as a fairly incendiary story about Manchester City.
Yes, Der Spiegel have unearthed more emails in relation to Manchester City. And this broadly is to do with financial fair play issues. But there were also some hints stroke allegations with regard to payments for recruiting youth players, which isn't allowed under both Premier League and UEFA rules. Now, we also know that it takes place all the time. If you've only got to read any of the regular stories or talk to agents, and they'll give you a slight sidelong glance, pull down the blinds, sweep the room for bugs, and say, "Well, this is how it really works, Kieran." Yeah. I'm aware of some very high profile players whose parents have been given unusual benefits from third parties not directly connected to clubs. But so there's issues with regards to, I think, Jadon Sancho. These are allegations. And then it comes to financial fair play. Now, if you want to circumvent financial fair play, there are two ways of doing this. First of all, you can artificially inflate income. And secondly, you can artificially deflate costs.
Yeah.
And the allegations, the inferences that were being made by Der Spiegel was that money was coming from the club owner rather than the sponsor, or in order to fund Manchester City. Now, under financial fair play, you are limited as to how much money from the club owner. You can put in as much money as you want, but only effectively the first 25 million euro over a rolling 3-year period counts. So that was the claim with regards to that, and there were some there were certainly some correspondence which didn't look great, but it, at the same time, was it a smoking gun? Would it be sufficient to reopen a case from CAS? Well, that's for the lawyers to determine. The other way to circumvent financial fair play is to artificially deflate costs. And the way that you can do this is that, let's say you want to pay somebody £10 million a year, but it ain't going to work for financial fair play purposes. What you do is that you pay them £4 million a year, and then you get a friendly party to employ them as an ambassador or have a separate contract for employment for doing something else for £6 million, which runs in parallel with the employment contract for the football club. So this is in respect of Roberto Mancini when he was the manager. And he did appear to have other contracts. Now, that's perfectly legal. You know, we see Cristiano Ronaldo advertising products all the time. We were discussing on last week's show about Lionel Messi signing a $20 million deal with Socios. Yeah. So that's okay, but I think the inference that was coming from Der Spiegel was that the only reason why some of these contracts had been given to Roberto Mancini was because it assisted Manchester City. Is that enough evidence? We don't know. There is a statute of limitations with regards to UEFA's own constitution as to how far they can go back, and clearly these things, the Roberto Mancini era is a good few years ago as Manchester City is concerned. There does appear to be an ongoing investigation by the Premier League, but the Premier League are being tight-lipped, Manchester City are being tight-lipped. Lawyers are going through Range Rover brochures at a rapid rate. Because they will be the biggest winners in whatever is going on behind the scenes. That's all we know.
There are several things I find intriguing about this story, Kieran, and I did read it. Unusually, it pricked my interest so much so that I read the entire thing, which is not like me, as you know. I normally take a couple of sentences out of context, and then you explain to me what I've done wrong when we get to the actual podcast. But first of all, the Mancini story, we know about, we've discussed that. You told me about that 18 months ago. So that's not new. What is new is Der Spiegel's clear implication that City have been financed by the government of Abu Dhabi, rather, as you say, by the owner of the club or by the sponsor. But also, within their report, Der Spiegel more or less say themselves that this is probably the last you'll hear from us because we simply can't compete with the government of Abu Dhabi, with Manchester City, when it comes to affording legal representation. So we probably can't continue this story. So they've dropped their little hand grenade in and walked back. But is the legal aspect one of the reasons why this story so utterly failed to be taken up by our press? Because I assumed when the Der Spiegel story came out that our press would be all over this. But nothing. No, they just showed no interest. Is that because it's not a story, or is that because they are afraid of legal outcomes in the same way that Der Spiegel clearly are?
It is in The Guardian. I think it has been covered by the BBC. Pep Guardiola was asked about it at his press conference on Friday, and he said, I'm a football manager. What happened before I arrived here, I don't know. And ultimately, the club's told me X, and I've no reason to disbelieve them. So it has been covered. It just doesn't seem to float the boat of some of the journalists. There are others who are following this. You know, people like Nick Harris, Tariq Panja, who are sort of very much from the investigative arm, and David Conn. These guys have been, regularly highlighting the issue. They would appear to believe you know, one end of the story. Manchester City are pushing back and saying, you know, this is all a conspiracy, that this is, you know, we are the victims in all of this, and also pointing out that the other clubs, or some other clubs in the Premier League, seem very keen to highlight this because they're all competing for four Champions League places. And as yeah. always, there's self-interest from all parties. And you know, I've always said to you, self-interest, there's nothing wrong with self-interest. We all operate on a self-interest on a daily basis. But I think for some of the other newspapers, they perhaps feel they got their fingers burnt when the Manchester City CAS verdict came out, and yeah. Manchester City, you know, their two-year ban was reversed. And they're looking for something bigger. And again, you read all of the stuff that came out from Der Spiegel, and yet it didn't look great. But is that enough for a successful prosecution?
Yeah.
I think the jury's very much out.
Yeah, see, I don't think it has been covered really, Kieran. I mean, it's been mentioned, but also I think it doesn't just reflect a fear of legal ramifications. I think it reflects a certain cynicism about football in general, in that most people will look at this and go, yeah, so we assume yeah. all the top clubs are doing this and working their way around all the regulations. Good luck to them. I wish my club could do it. Unfortunately, yeah. that seems to be the attitude.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you entirely.
Yeah,
yeah. If as soon as you start digging below the surface of any club, nobody's squeaky clean. Yeah. And that's I've no issue with that. You know, we like a bit of dirt in football. Let's face it, this podcast would have died on its arse.
Yeah.
Within two episodes, had it not been for things like that. So let's not be hypocrites on this. Yeah, it is a bit of juicy gossip. Ultimately, it's a potential legal dispute or issue between two or three parties. And I'd much rather be talking about Brighton's performance yesterday at Arsenal, along with thousands of people.
Let's move on from that, Kieran. Stop.
Okay, let's move
stop,
on.
Stop banging on about that, for the love of God. Some of us scored three goals against Arsenal. Come on now. This is a story that won't be subject of investigative journalism or much gossip, except outside a particular part of Sussex. And that is that Crawley Town have completed their takeover, and their new owners are involved in an industry in which everybody seems to be involved in at the moment, Kieran, don't they?
Yes. So the takeover of Crawley Town did take place. And I was slightly alarmed to be quoted in the local Sussex newspaper who interviewed me when they start stating my age. Now what point does my age, Maguire, 60, said, hold on.
Clearly implying, Kieran, that you're losing your marbles at the great age of... It's an interesting one, because it's one of the things that I'm sure the Baroness would agree with Ali on this one, that she gets absolutely furious when they say in the media they reveal a woman's age, and quite right, whatever your age is not, it's just Maguire. So having said that, Kieran, it is all over your Twitter feed. Your girl yes. is 60, clumsy, and shy. So, but
well,
yes.
I thought I was a play on words or from half a person by the Smiths. So,
also, to be fair, Kieran, you are probably the biggest name they've interviewed for quite some time in Crawley.
In the Crawley Advertiser.
Yeah, since Ramesh Ranganathan moved out of Crawley to wherever it is, they're short of news now, Kieran. So, but yes, yeah, so tell us about WAGME United, who have taken this club over.
Right, WAGME stands for We're all gonna make it.
Oh, Christ.
So instantly, alarm bells, Jesus Christ comes into this.
Oh, my Lord. On Palm Sunday as well. Crikey. Yeah.
I won't say that about Palm Sunday.
no, don't, Kieran. Please.
No, we've still got the BAFTA chance.
Yes, at the moment. Yes, yeah.
They're American owners. WAGME United Limited is a company formed with £1 worth of shares.
Right.
One English pound. So, but apparently, they funnily enough, they are a W3 stroke crypto company. But the previous owner, by all accounts, he says, I'll have cash, lads, if you don't mind. good luck with all your stuff. So it was sort of announced on another podcast for people who are interested in that. And I think it's fair to say I did sort of listen to them talking about it, and I started to play the game of crypto bingo.
Yeah.
So they managed to mention W3, drop, community, space, traders, engagement, benefits, FOMO, and I had to Google that, and that was it wasn't in the Viz Profanosaurus. FOMO stands for fear of missing out. So yeah. You've got to get in with this, kids, otherwise you could be millionaires. What their aim is, and this could work. I mean, Crawley Town is it's got 700 season ticket holders. It's probably punching above its weight in EFL League Two. It potters along, and as somebody that lives in Sussex, I always sort of you keep a quiet eye on how they're getting on. They have a limit as to what they can achieve under present circumstances, and the aim of the new owners is to encourage the community. Mm-hmm. To buy our good friends NFTs. And again, for people who are not familiar, what is an NFT? It is a digital asset. It's the equivalent of a Panini card, except instead of having a physical version that you open from a pack, you can buy some of these and you don't know what you're going to get a lot of the time, and you'll get a cartoon picture or a photograph of a Crawley Town footballer. Now, here we've got, I think, under normal circumstances, you'd say, so I think there's a natural limit to the market for these. But I think what the owners are taking the view of, as this is the first crypto club in the EFL, will crypto traders, now what is a crypto trader? A crypto trader is a bloke living with his mum who eats pot noodles at night, who calls himself a trader, but actually, a trader is to me, when I hear the word trader, I know currency traders, I know oil traders who work in Canary Wharf. These people that call themselves traders on the internet, I think they're a bit more low key than that. What they're going to try to do is all of these people who listen to the podcasts, who follow the guys who are the owners on Twitter and so on, they are hoping that they are going to buy into Crawley Town because they're going to become the flagship club for the W3 crypto NFT market. And therefore, somebody who's got absolutely no interest in football and has not any interest in Crawley Town, they will buy some of the NFTs because they're buying into something in which these people believe. So that's where they hope the money's going to come from. We were saying only last week, Liverpool had an NFT drop, and 90% of it went unsold. Yeah. So it's going to involve a fair amount of persuasion. So long as we still have a Crawley Town to talk about in 5 years' time, my view is good luck to them. What I am concerned about is what happens if their initial drop is a flop, and then they say, toys out of pram. Oh, this wasn't quite what we envisaged, and then the club's got problems.
Well, this is the big fear, isn't it, Kieran? You mentioned the 700 season ticket holders at Crawley, and for those 700 people, Crawley Town is probably one of the most important, if not the important thing in their life. And you worry that these new owners are taking over not a football club but a marketing enterprise in their book, basically, that they're going to get, they will get 4 weeks of publicity in the way that Peter McCormack got 4 weeks of good publicity out of buying his club in Bedford, and then you think, well, what's going to happen after that? And it's life's difficult enough as it is as a Crawley fan, and there might be some initial interest and excitement, but then, as you say, if Liverpool fans are not buying NFTs, it's hard to see that global football fans will buy them for Crawley Town. Although, do you know what? It does surprise me, Kieran. If you go through Gatwick Airport, I always think Crawley miss a trick and just say, look, if you're stuck at Gatwick for a couple of hours, as millions of people are at the moment, why not pop down to Crawley Town, see if there's a game going on? Questions time, Kieran. We've spent quite a lot of time on those two news stories. And our first question is about financial fair play. And it's quite a simple one, but I'm asking it because I think as you've even implied, some of us are still not fully grasping the point of it and why we've had it for so long and it's going to change. But so it comes from Joseph Duda. And Joseph Duda lives in the United States and says, we have the franchise model with our sports teams, which, says Joseph, he hates, and we have salary caps. But I have a question about your financial fair play. It doesn't seem very fair. From what I've read, and I could be wrong, welcome to my world, Joseph, a team's owner can put money in it to cover the losses of a club for 3 years. Is that right? If not, could you give a better explanation of it and how is it enforced? And obviously, Kieran, we've already had 22 minutes and 48 seconds. So if you could do that in less than 22 minutes and 48 seconds, that would be great.
Sure. I think, first of all, Joseph has raised the relevant point about people think that the word fair in financial fair play implies that there is some sort of sporting fairness in it. That was never the intention. And certainly under the new rules, and we'll talk about the new rules in the probably next Thursday show, that's going to accelerate away from any form of sporting integrity. But under the rules, owners can put in as much money into the clubs as they like. Now, if they put it in the form of loans, it doesn't count towards FFP at all. But if they put it in the form of shares, then under UEFA rules, effectively the first 30 million euro counts over a three-year period, although that's going to be extended to 60 million. In the Premier League, it's 105 million, and in the EFL, it's 39. Now, so if you put in 200 million into a Premier League club, the first 105 million is added into your FFP calculations to ensure that you're within the limits. Any excess above that is excluded. So that's the way that the system works, Joseph. It's got absolutely nothing to do with fairness. We have now renamed the rules, of course, here in England to profitability and sustainability. And looking at the rules, they've got nothing to do with profitability and nothing to do with sustainability either. So, you know, it's a complete misnomer, the titles that are given to this. There's nothing noble or egalitarian about them. It's mainly to do with protectionism as far as the Premier League and UEFA are concerned. It's better in the EFL, in my opinion. But it is all going to be revamped soon.
But, you know, that fair play element, Kieran, is interesting because until I started doing this pod with you 2 years ago, and I'm a reasonably intelligent bloke, except when it comes to money, as we know, but I assumed that the fair play part of financial fair play was to try and create a level playing field to ensure that money couldn't buy you success. And I couldn't have got that more wrong, could I?
It's the exact opposite. It's to protect those clubs that have an existing financial advantage. Anybody with ambition. So, you know, if somebody wants to put £500 million into a club in the form of shares, and, you know, the nature of shares is that they never have to be repaid, then you can't do that and invest all of that into your playing squad. If we take a look at those clubs, you know, Chelsea and Manchester City, and their fans will admit this, they both struck gold in Abramovich and Sheikh Mansour in terms of the way those clubs were transformed. Could other clubs also strike gold in the years following the introduction of financial fair play? The answer is no. The old money does not like new money. Yeah. And all of these rules are there to protect old money clubs.
Now, our next question comes from a regular listener, Debashish Sikdar. And Debashish has a question about something else that's exercising our listeners at the moment, and that's stadiums. Debashish says, why is it so important for football clubs to own their stadium? Most major corporations and organisations don't actually own the offices or factories they operate in. Is it just that it's near on impossible for them to move location?
Well, there's actually nothing wrong with renting a stadium and having a landlord, provided the landlord is benevolent. So if the landlord's ethos and belief for that local town or city aligns with the fan base and aligns with the club itself, then everybody can work and succeed together. The problem is where the landlord becomes a developer or is a developer. You know, we've seen the company associated with Ian Rush. You know, that's involved clubs effectively losing their rights to play. What happens if the developer? If we take a look at Southend, you know, the ground is effectively owned by the owner, and in an ideal world, he wants the club to move to an out of town space because there's retail or there's domestic property potential, because it's a big plot of land, a football ground. And if we go back to the history of football clubs, they used to be central because football was there before public transport is the way that we have it today. So that's the concern. There's also an issue in terms of what happens if a football club goes into administration, but the stadium doesn't, because it makes the administrator's job a lot harder. And I think we all know which club we're talking about here. Yeah. And the other issue is if you are the tenant, that means that you are often restricted on non-match days as to sweating the assets, as to generating money. So Spurs do own their stadium. Spurs are very, very good, in my view, at utilizing the new ground on non-match days. Yeah, they've got the NFL, they've got concerts. They're hoping to have fights there and so on. And you can walk over the Spurs walk and so on. And everything is geared towards separating people from their wallets. Now, that's the Disneyfication of football. I understand it. I'm the same as you. I'm an old Legacy fan. I wouldn't choose to do it myself, but each to their own. And if I went to Barcelona on a Thursday and nothing to do, I'd probably go and visit the ground for exactly those purposes. If we then take a look at West Ham, West Ham don't have those same rights, and it is more restrictive. So that's the downside. So, I think from a protection of the club point of view, that's why we start to get a bit twitchy when there is this separation. We've seen what's happened at Coventry, and other clubs when the club no longer owned the stadium. It's increasing risk, but not necessarily a bad thing, because if the landlord's good, all's fine. If the landlord's less than good, problems.
Yeah, do you think they make that Spurs walk realistic? Because like for the first three quarters of it, you stride out full of confidence, and then just as it gets towards the end, the legs start to go a little bit, and they have to drag you across the line.
Should we call it the Spursy walk?
That'd be great. I would do the Spursy walk. As you say, Kieran, it's quite right, and I speak from experience, as you do, that when you don't own your stadium, when you're leasing it from Ron Noe, there is a certain unease about it. It doesn't feel quite right. There's another question here based on US sports, and it comes from Ben Hyten. And Ben Hyten says he saw a video the other day which talked about how easily it is for a video. How long? This waiting list for questions is getting very long.
If it's
Betamax, we're definitely in trouble. Ben saw a video which talked about how easily it is for NFL and baseball teams to move players out of their clubs without even having to notify them until the deal is done. The player can be told you've been traded to such and such a team on the other side of the country without being consulted or giving consent. What different rules, regulations around contracts here make it much harder for football teams to do this, as it seems that most of the time player power wins? It certainly does for high-profile players, yes.
Yes, yeah. I mean, this is a cracking one from Ben, and it has. I've often wondered about this one myself. In the NFL, effectively, you've got the centralization of contracts, and as far as trades are concerned, and remember, you cannot have a fee when there's an NFL trade.
Yeah.
So you've got to swap either player X for player Y. And it's now becoming increasingly difficult because of the NFL draft system. What you can do is that you can swap two or three players, but you can also swap your picks on the draft. So it's quite complex. It's also relatively rare compared to the transfer market that we have in football here in the UK and Europe and so on. And part of the reason why it's rare in the States is that normally when a player signs for an NFL club, they get a huge signing on bonus. So, you know, if you then 12 months later decide that you don't want that player, you've already paid out a massive amount of money.
Yeah.
And unlike a football player trade, you're not going to get any of that back because all of that money's gone to the player. With football, it all comes down to employment law, and you've got a contract of employment with the employer for a fixed period of time. You've also got a registration certificate, which is held by the club and lodged with the football authorities, and it's that's being transferred. So the footballer is in a position to say, I've got a contract of employment with, say, Crystal Palace. If Manchester United come in for a player, if I'm happy living where I am, yeah, my family's settled, I'm getting regular play, do I want to go to Manchester? You've got to persuade me. So it's there to the rules protect the players to a certain extent. They only move if they if it's in their interest. Now, how do we make it in their interest? You normally do that by offering them more money. At the same time, you know, we're both old enough and, you know, experienced enough to know that if the club wants you out, it can make things uncomfortable for the player, in the sense of you have to go and play, or you have to go and train with the youth academy, or you're not allowed into team meetings and so on. So it's not impossible for clubs to force players out, but it's certainly a lot more difficult. In the States, as you say, you find out via a phone call or a text from your club.
Mm. Our next question comes from Adam Hunt. Hello, Adam. Sorry, I made that sound quite sinister, didn't I? Hello, Adam. Sorry. Adam Hunt says, recently Doncaster Bells captain Sophie Scargill badly injured her knee in training, which resulted in her needing surgery. Now, she needed to go private because of the length of the NHS waiting list to be able to continue her career. And it cost around £5,000. And the club Doncaster offered to loan her the money for the treatment, which she declined and decided to crowdfund instead, which was a success, helped by contributions from a few big names like Gary Lineker and Danny Rose. But shouldn't the club and owners have been responsible for funding this treatment rather than offering to loan her the money? Now, I mean, we've spoken to an insurance expert recently, Kieran, and my instinct is if this accident happens at work while she's training, you'd think the club, even though £5,000 is a lot of money for a women's football team, you'd think surely that's the club's responsibility to cough up for that, isn't it?
You would think perhaps they would have some insurance policy. I think there's a number of issues here. And first of all, congratulations. Sophie is now back playing. And I think she got a goal and an assist for Doncaster Bells last week. So, you know, it's good that this has come through. And also fair play to, you know, Gary Lineker putting £3,000. And it does show that all of the negativity that we have in relation to footballers is actually, you know quite a few. I've got to know quite a few. I've always found them to be absolutely brilliant. You know, because at the end of the day, they're sons and brothers and dads and so on, just like us all. I think with regards to women's football, there was a change in the rules for the WSL in 2019. And now that there is medical insurance provided by clubs, Doncaster Bells are in the fourth tier of women's football. And that degree of cover does not go down as far as the fourth tier. Doncaster Bells are a loss-making club, like many clubs, as we know. They made that decision. Now, you know, they will have their reasons for doing so. You know, clearly from an individual person's perspective, you know, Sophie, I think, you know, the waiting list for her operation was a year and a half, which, you know, that's a separate issue, you know, with regards to the funding of health in this country. She did go down the private route. She didn't have the money herself because as a fourth tier women's footballer, you're not on a lot of money to begin with. So should they morally? I think they've got a responsibility, but legally they don't.
I guarantee that Gary Lineker would have got several tweets thanking him for his contribution. And several hundred saying, you're a multimillionaire, mate. You could have paid for it all.
yeah.
And he would have got one tweet saying, you shit on the pitch. Because it makes him laugh a lot. The same bloke, every tweet that Gary Lineker sends, this bloke replies by saying, you shit on the pitch, mate. Every single one. I think it's reached a stage where Gary would be worried about the bloke if he didn't get a tweet from him. talking of football at the less wealthy end, there's a question here from Gareth Loke. And Gareth's question is about a team, as he says, at the other end of the spectrum to money-rich PSG, Man City, and now Newcastle. And it's Lincoln Red Imps of Gibraltar. And it's one of those team names that you love when you occasionally hear it, normally around June or July on Sky in a pre-qualifying game or whatever. But they have qualified for their first European group stage in the Europa Conference League. And Gareth wonders how much money they will gain from being in the competition.
Right. Well, I think this could be, I think, very significant for Lincoln Red Imps. You get a flat fee for the achievement. And first of all, extremely well done to Lincoln Red Imps of €2.9 million.
Oh, wow.
For getting, yeah. So that's a game changer. On top of that, you get €500,000 for a win, €166,000 for a draw. And then there are other bits and pieces which will be linked to your UEFA coefficient, which is worth, and for people unfamiliar, what happens is that UEFA rank all 32 clubs in the Europa Conference, and you get, that's based on your previous performances within Europe. And the club that's bottom of the coefficient gets 44,000. The club second from bottom gets double that. The club third from bottom, three times that, and so on. So depending upon how you've progressed in European competition, and it's effectively parachute payments under a different name, then you get more and more money. And that's the same in Europa Conference, the Europa League, and the Champions League. And they'll get some money as well from what's known as the market pool, which is linked to the amount of money their domestic broadcaster has paid for the rights. And I'm not being rude. I suspect Gibraltar TV probably hasn't paid a huge amount of money because it's a relatively small population. So yes, we're probably talking at least €3 million. If they have a good run and good luck to them, then it could be considerably more than that for clubs. Clubs in Gibraltar, it's a small league. It will have a very significant impact upon their finances.
Yeah, they played Celtic a couple of years ago, didn't they? What they want, they want to play as many British teams as possible because, my experience is that football fans in Germany, for example, or in Romania, aren't that fussed about travelling to new grounds, whereas over here, you get the chance to go and see Lincoln Red Imps play, and 5,000 of you are going to try and get tickets to go out there. Although a friend of mine went to Gibraltar for a wedding recently, said it's very nice, but not impressed by the apes. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ollie K says, when a potential buyer is looking to buy a football club, and this is an interesting one, I think, how much do they take into account the market value of the players a club has? It feels like it makes sense to take into account, but also seems difficult to do so, considering how debatable player values are and how quickly they can change. For example, if you are looking to buy Spurs, it's difficult to say whether they have a £1 million asset in Kane or a £150 million asset. And I suppose as well, Declan Rice is a classic example now. There's a debate going on about how much he's worth. So if somebody is looking to buy West Ham, are they going, well, I need to know how much this player's worth because he's an asset?
Well, yes, because if you're making any investment, you look at the assets and the liabilities that you're acquiring. And what you would do is because, yeah, the chances are that if somebody does, you know, Daniel Kretinsky, who is the Czech investor, who's tipped to take his investment from 27% to much higher to gain control of Spurs, so it's a good gain control of West Ham in a couple of years, he will have taken advice. But Ollie's exactly right. Yeah, the value of a player is volatile. It's a bit like shares. It's a bit like cryptocurrency. You know, values can go up as well as down. But one thing to take into consideration is that if you are going to acquire a club and if you're looking as players as assets, if you sell them, it's not like if I buy some property assets and I buy, you know, a row of four shops, and I say, well, I only need two of them. I can sell two of them myself. With a football club, if you're looking to buy the club and sell two or three players, you can't play a match with eight. So therefore, if you're going to sell players worth 150 million, realistically, if you want to maintain your status, then you're going to have to go and replace them with purchases of a similar level. So that's one thing to take into consideration. But, you know, where do you get player values from? You can look at places like transfermarket.com, but you then listen to the chief executive of transfermarket.com, and he says, don't rely on our values because they are, and again, it comes from the community.
Yeah.
So what's the community? It's lots of people playing FIFA in their bedrooms who say, well, according to, yeah, when I play with such of this player on FIFA, he's absolutely fantastic. And then they go to transfer market and they change the player values. It's as simple as that. So trying to get a definitive value for a squad is nigh on impossible. It does mean that buying football clubs is a bit of a punt.
Our next two questions, Kieran, take us to Scotland, which is a country we're always happy to visit. And the first one comes from Ewan Hodgart. Apologies, Ewan, that should be Hodgart, but we'll stick him with Hodgart for the moment. Ewan says, you regularly state that because of the structure of prize money, parachute payments, etc., in Scottish football, that failure doesn't have such dire financial consequences as in the English leagues or other leagues. You do, Kieran. You talk about the slope versus the precipice. Following relegation to the Scottish Championship last season, Kilmarnock owner Billy Bowie stated that the player budget would remain the same for this season. Now, it looks like Killy will go back, but was that a risky strategy?
I don't think so. The difference between the bottom of the Premier League and the top of the Championship is £500,000 in prize money.
Right.
Now, if you compare that to the bottom of the Premier League and the top of the Championship, we're probably talking 120 million. So by having Killy, yeah, and Killy is a club, you know, looking at its results, broadly, it takes that Scottish approach of aiming to break even. It's a lot easier to break even in the Premiership than it is in the Championship because you know that you're guaranteed two or three sellouts from home matches a season from the visit of, you know, clubs who we don't even need to name.
Yeah.
and the additional interest because you're going to be picked on a few more occasions for TV. But I think as a one season issue, Kilmarnock's wage bill is in the region of sort of £2.5 to £3 million. That's less than the average pay of a Premier League footballer. So they do operate a tight budget. Historically, they've never been paying out more than sort of 50 to 60% of wages from income in a Premiership season. If that goes up to 80% or 90% for one season in the Championship, then they will see that as money well spent. So I don't perceive this as being a major risk, and certainly from talking to people in the Championship, they are the biggest payers and the biggest hitters in that division.
Our next Scottish question comes from Ewan John Robert Morrison. Now, occasionally, Kieran, we have questions from people who just give us one name. So yes. Ewan John Robert has balanced that out a little bit. Thank you, Ewan. Ewan says, I'm an Aberdeen fan. Probably an unhappy Aberdeen fan this morning then, because they've just split into the top and bottom six, and Aberdeen surprisingly in the bottom six with Hibs, for the love of God. But John says, I'm an Aberdeen fan, and against Dundee, I noticed something odd about the players on our bench. One of them was a young goalkeeper called Tom Ritchie, who was covering due to our club captain goalkeeper being ill. Now, what's odd is that he's on loan at Huntley in the Highland League and played for them a few days before. He also plays for our youth team. How is this allowed? Is this something put in place to encourage clubs to not hoard young goalkeepers in the reserves in case of scenarios like this?
Yeah, yes. There will have been, first of all, a recall clause in respect of Tom. What we tend to see in addition to that is that there are special issues with regards to goalkeepers, because it is a unique position. And whilst there isn't necessarily a lot of sympathy if a couple of centre halves get injured, you will say, why can't the fullback, or there's an acknowledgement that because of the specialist nature of goalkeeping, you are able to pick up people on short-term contracts or have recall clauses, as would appear to be the case with Tom Ritchie. You say he's only 18. I did a bit of Googling. He looks, I think he's getting into the Scottish young people squad, and bright future for him. So, hopefully he'll be off the bench and in the first team.
Now, Thomas Franks has a question. I love a question, which is one of those questions which goes, why have I not thought of this before? And I think this is really interesting. Thomas Frank says, his question is about Premier League partners and sponsors and how that affects the teams in the league. I was thinking about the fact that no clubs in the Premier League have a banking sponsor. Is this because Barclays, one of the main Premier League sponsors, have an agreement with the league that no club can have a conflicting sponsor to them? If this is the case, how do companies like Hublot and Budweiser not have the same privilege over clubs with watch and beer sponsors?
Yeah, I think this is a cracker from Tom. I think here you've got to look at the wording of the contracts very carefully. Yeah, Barclays is the official bank of the Premier League. It's also sponsoring the Women's Championship, I think, from next season, and it's putting a lot of money into the WSL. So fair play to them for that. It is a growing area of the game. Whilst it is their official banking sponsor, if we take a look at some other clubs who have finance sponsors, so it's I think it's a case of you've got to look at the wording very carefully. Liverpool was sponsored by Standard Chartered, or a finance company. My team are sponsored by Amex, again, a finance company, but they don't call themselves the banking partner. So this is all to do with wording. Certainly, Barclays are very keen to be the banking sponsor of the Premier League, not least at all because it allows them to get access to players. And what Barclays are very keen to do is to get involved in what's known as wealth management. Given that the average salary of a Premier League footballer is somewhere in the region of £2.7 million a year, you need somebody looking after that money, and I think Barclays have seen this as sort of a step-by-step approach into getting access to the players and their representatives to give them financial advice. So that's why it is the case. If we take a look at Hublot and alcohol sponsors, the wording of those contracts, one might be the official timekeeper of the Premier League, and another one will be the official watch supplier of such and such a club. And when it, you know, as we know from our legal friends, wording is very, very important.
Yeah. Now, you and I did the responsible thing last week, Kieran, and we missed out on our trip to the Papa John's final because of the faintest of faint lines on the COVID test. And of course, we missed out on a cracking game.
We did.
But would, for example, Papa John, who I'm sure is a delightful chap, but would he get the hump if one of the teams in his tournament turns out in a Domino's Pizza sponsored shirt?
He wouldn't be particularly happy. This is sometimes referred to as guerrilla advertising.
Yeah.
But you know, we're aware, for example, that Stevenage is sponsored by Burger King.
Yeah.
You know, so. You know, there is an overlap. And one way around of it to say that, you know, this for this particular match, you know, Papa John's will still have the benefits of having perimeter advertising. Is that a helicopter?
A helicopter. Yeah, they're still looking for Uncle Terry. I haven't had the heart to tell the local police the bad news about Uncle Terry, but it's the usual Sunday morning flyover. It's just because it's so bloody sunny, I've got the door open, basically.
Right. So it comes down to wording. Papa John's, when they sign the contract with the EFL, they will be given, first of all, the naming rights to the tournament. Secondly, I did watch the match. I mean, I contracted COVID, I think, on Thursday or Friday, so I was gutted, same as you. But they also get all the perimeter advertising, and was the match ball brought on by a Papa John's moped or something like that? They pay for various benefits with the EFL, but that doesn't override existing contracts with individual clubs with other potential sponsors.
Yeah, it was the Thursday or Friday of the weekend before that you contracted COVID, Kieran. So it was on the 10th day. Any other podcast host would have just said, "Oh, we've had it 10 days, we won't go." But we didn't want to be a super spread. We didn't want to be responsible for Rick Parry getting COVID, essentially. Well, one of us didn't, Kieran, let's put it that way. We have one question left, and then we've got a couple left over from the live show. And I'm aware that this is already 52 minutes in, so perhaps we could keep this answer relatively short. Simon Staines has asked a question which people like to ask us when they meet us in person. Well, they like to ask you. But Simon says, which clubs below National League Premier level, for example, do you think have the most potential to become a Football League side and possess to higher levels? In other words, who are the sleeping giants? He says, National League North and South or below. Until somebody comes up with something better than sleeping giants, that's fine. In the same way as a comedy writer, there is nothing that goes up and down like a roller coaster. You sit there and you go, we can't say a roller coaster ride. And then you think, well, what else goes up and down? It's just, I don't know, a dragon.
Umbrellas.
You go up and down like that hasn't got the same effect.
No, it hasn't really. No, like no.
An umbrella. A bride's nighty, as was that great song, was it up and down like a bride's nighty? That again, that ages us.
That does age us.
Who was that? It was the same guy who did Jill. I know him. He's a mate. Who did that song?
Graham Fellows.
Yes, Graham Fellows. Yeah, it was delightful. It's very funny, that song. Up and down like a... No, anyway. So the Sleeping Giants, Kieran, in that BAFTA have gone.
Right. I sort of divided this between National League North and National League South. Now, my conclusions came that it would be mainly National League North. National League North clubs have got a lot of professional clubs. National League South is nearly all part-time.
Is there a reason? We've discussed this before, Kieran. Is there a reason for that? Is it just that coincidentally most of the clubs in National League South are smaller or haven't been in higher leagues before?
I think it's a combination of both of those. Ultimately, if we go back to the history of football, it was working class towns mainly in the north. The initial football association. You look at the teams involved, and it was very much concentrated in the north of England. So clubs that have gone have fallen on hard times. We've got York City, we've got Hereford, we've got Chester, all of whom, I can remember York City in the equivalent of the Championship. Chester was always a good day out. Hereford has got a special memory for all Brighton fans as well. Huh. But one other one which I would pick out, and this might make me unpopular with some, would be AFC Fylde. Mainly because they appear to have quite a lot of financial backing from an owner. And we've seen with Salford City that can accelerate you through into the EFL. When it came to National League South, I put on my hipster gear.
Yeah.
I twirled my moustache. I got on my penny farthing, and instantly it had to be Dulwich Hamlet.
Really?
Because I think there's a romance about that club, in my view, that could make it very attractive. Just as lots of people go to Germany to watch St. Pauli, yeah, who are sort of the anarchist, the anti-establishment club. I think Dulwich Hamlet could market themselves on those lines. Accelerate and make progress on the back of that.
Well, they do that very well. Dulwich is just down the road for me. It's very much not where I live, I hasten to point out, but it's only a couple of stops away, and a friend of mine lives there. And when you get off the train at Dulwich Hamlet, you're immediately surrounded by references to the football club, which is very close to the station. They do that very well. There are banners, posters, all the local shops have a Dulwich presence. The pub is full of photographs of old Dulwich teams. So I think they're aware of that marketing opportunity, and that's an interesting, but would they not struggle obviously with the fact that they've got Wimbledon Palace, Millwall very close to them?
Yes, but in the same way that we still have a Rochdale and London,
yeah, that's a fair point.
A resurgent Stockport as well. In the city of Manchester, I think there is a place for a successful non-league stroke League Two team in that area. It won't be easy because the National League itself is full time, and I think that would be the big barrier. So they'd have to have, if they had the right financial backers, then I think that there is an opportunity there.
Yeah, and also actually thinking about it, and we spoke to the chief exec of Dulwich a year or so ago. If they did that thing where they were playing on a Friday night, I think I'd only be too happy to go and see Dulwich play on a Friday night and Palace on a Saturday. Now, we have two questions left, Kieran. And remember, at the live show, we had so many questions that we couldn't get to. We did promise we would answer some of them on the pod. So these last two of that. And the first one was probably more relevant at the time for a worried Derby fan like Martin Plummer, because Martin wanted to ask us a couple of weeks ago, if we get a takeover of my club, Derby, would the club own the stadium and training ground again, or would they still be owned by Mel Morris? And we have spoken about this in line with the preferred bidder announcement last week, but it's just worth a quick summary, Kieran, for Martin.
Yes, Mel Morris officially would still own the stadium. I have been given a rough summary of the offer from Chris Kirchner.
Uh-huh.
I think in an ideal world, he would like the stadium to be bought by the local council, and he would then rent it from them. I think he's very keen on the EFL to apply the 15-point penalty this season, because Derby are, I hate to say it, Derby are almost down.
Yeah.
From what I heard, it would be very bad news for both HMRC and unsecured creditors. But yeah, that's just something I picked up on the wire, shall we say? But if that's the best offer, then it shows that Mel Morris, to a large extent, appears to be have a lot of control over these things, because he could have put the stadium into administration, or he could have given the stadium to the supporters' trust to manage for the future of the club, and he chose to do neither of those, to look after his own financial interests.
I know a lot of Derby fans tweeted us jokingly saying how much they look forward to the time when they're not on your contents list that you tweet before each pod. But is this not a worrying sign if the potential new owner doesn't want to buy the ground, or he wants somebody else to buy the ground, does that mean he can't afford it, or he doesn't think it's a financial risk worth taking?
Well, given that he bid for the club in December, and that bid was fairly firmly rejected by Quantamar at the time, he won't be bidding more.
Right.
You know, because we're 4 months later down the road. The probability of relegation is higher now than it was then. And a lot of the saleable assets in the form of players have been sold by the administrators to fund the monthly wage bill.
Yeah.
So, and also, you know, he did bid for Preston, and that got knocked back as well. And, you know, I suspect that, you know, Derby has you know, a bigger fan base than Preston, and has got a bigger stadium, even though it's not in administration. So it does make you wonder as to the extent of the bid. But if my sources are correct, you're never certain on these things. Right. It didn't look like a great bid for a lot of people in Derby who are not necessarily directly connected to the football club.
Yeah. We also had a tweet, Kieran, saying it's not Quantamar, it's Quantumar. But until the unlikely day that Quantamar or Quantumar get in touch with us to tell us how you do pronounce it, and they've resolutely refused to get in touch with us so far on any other subject, so I doubt if they'll get in touch with that. We're sticking with Quantamar. Our final question comes from Nick H., Nick H. And Nick says, what do you think about the marriage between private equity and football? Who benefits most, and can it be football?
Well, the nature of private equity is the focus is on cost cutting, the focus is on bottom line, the focus is on a return on investment, and the focus is on finding an exit route. Because if you buy the club for 50 million, you're looking to sell it for 150 million, normally in 3 to 5 years' time. You know, a normal private equity approach to acquisition and disposal of business goes along those lines. Does football benefit from any of that? No, it doesn't. So private equity is interested in football because it sees money to be made. Private equity people are not football fans. As a legacy fan who knows a little bit about finance, I'm extremely nervous when I see these references to private equity coming in to rescue clubs or rescue, in the case of like the likes of La Liga and so on. There is the opportunity for both parties to benefit, but I know which of those parties is going to benefit the most, and it's not going to be football.
Well, speaking of private equity, thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to our always free-to-air pod, then go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall leave you in the hands of Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks for everybody that does support us via Patreon. It's very kind of you, and we genuinely appreciate it. There's other ways that you can support the show as well, and that's by going on to your podcast provider and leaving us a review. It doesn't matter, whether it's Spotify or Google Podcasts or Apple or the Apple Podcast app. It helps us in the charts. It helps us to have a bit of credibility when we're trying to book some guests, and we've got some cracking guests coming up in the next few weeks as well, which we're really looking forward to have a chat to. There's a story about Barry Hearn and my ex-wife, which I probably won't tell, but
it depends who comes out. Let's tell you what, let's make a decision now, Kieran, and say no, don't tell it.
Okay. The way that you can do that is to give us a review. If you give us 5 stars, if you think we're worth it, of course, that would be fantastic. And it doesn't matter what you say. Myself and Kevin's egos can cope with it. Even if you'd said you'd rather the show was presented by Betty Boothroyd and Scatman John.
Sorry, that's very far. I'm still thinking about Barry Hearn and your ex-wife. Did he drive a snooker loopy, Kieran?
Yes. Yes.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. the price of football.